Now, yesterday we finished F, I believe, which was Calvin in Strasbourg, and we turned our attention to G, which would naturally stand for Geneva. G is Geneva, 1541 to 1547. Now, we're only looking here at 6 years in Calvin's life. These are the 6 years which saw the last part of Luther's life. Well, I hope that most of you know that Luther died in 1546. 1547 is the year when the emperor gained complete control of Germany. It's the year when Henry VIII of England died, which will be of great importance in our later study when we get to the English Reformation. But as far as our present observation is concerned, 1547 is sort of a turning point, as we'll see toward the end of this particular subject. But now under this, we call one the return to Geneva, September 1541. Calvin, a young man, only 32 years of age now, was brought back to Geneva as the chief pastor. He had three other pastors working with him. And he soon found in the meetings that they had every week of all the pastors together in discussion, he soon found that these three were very men of little ability and men of considerable selfishness in their general attitude. But he had learned a little tact and judgment by this time, and he did not act precipitously. However, in the course of the next 5 years, all three of these, well, there was one of them who was a very high-class man, but he was called to Lausanne to be pastor there. So Calvin had his fellowship, but no longer his assistance in the work in Geneva. The other two he got rid of in the course of the next 5 years, and he was able to find men who were a real help to him in the work. But he carried on pretty much as had been before, and endeavor to go forward along the lines that he and Farrell had been working. In a way, it was much harder for him. Farrell had been the nominal leader before. Farrell was 20 years older. He'd introduced the Reformation into the city. He had a great standing. Calvin was a very young man, and he did not have Farrell's counsel, though they got together every now and then. Neuchâtel was not so far away, but he didn't have his prestige and his strong assistance. But he worked energetically and accomplished a great deal during these 6 years. After number two under G will be new ordinances of religion. New ordinances of religion. The government had adopted ordinances of religion before. These new ordinances are not greatly different from those that Farrell and Geneva had introduced before. Certain of the features involved we will look at under forehead, small a, the venerable company. That was the name they gave to the group of the ministers. That included the ministers from Geneva and ministers from surrounding areas, that is from small towns in the neighborhood, who would meet once a week. They were called the venerable company. Calvin never presided at these meetings, or at least rarely, if ever. He had no official position as leadership among the ministers, but by his personality and by his ability, he exerted a tremendous influence among them. And they constantly were benefiting one another in increasing their effectiveness. A small b, the consistory. And this is something that Calvin had introduced before when he was there with Farrell, and on which he laid great stress. The Roman Catholic, yes, the consistory, C-O-N-S-I-S-T-O-R-Y, the consistory. Calvin laid great stress on one point where he felt the Roman Catholic Church was very much in error. The idea that had developed in the Roman Catholic Church through the Middle Ages was that the church consisted of the clergy. The church was those who had been ordained and set apart. It included the priests, the monks, the bishops, the various members of the hierarchy. They were the church, and the laity are all in a very vastly inferior area. It is only within our last 10 years that great efforts are being made by the Roman Church to extend the influence and power of the laity and to bring them more into active participation in the church. But one of the great central ideas of the Reformation was the universal priesthood of believers, that the minister is only an assistant, a help, an advisor. It is not through him you receive salvation. Christ is the only mediator between God and man. The minister does not bring you salvation as the Roman Catholic priest was supposed to do. He points you to Christ through whom you can receive salvation. And Calvin carried this out in the matter of church government. He was very insistent that the laity have a tremendously important part in the running of the church. And so he developed this idea of the consistory. This had been brought forward while Farrell and Calvin were both there in Geneva. The consistory there was appointed by the council. The council selected from its own membership certain men to be leaders or elders or representatives of the laity. These men had each a certain section of Geneva for which he was responsible. And these men were supposed every year to visit every family in this section, usually one of the ministers going with them, as they visited each family and discussed with them their spiritual life. And when they would hear questions about the religious attitude or development of individuals in their area, they would bring them to the consistory and would discuss them there. And the consistory would decide whether special measures were necessary in the case of individuals in order to show them their sin, lead them to turn away from it, in order to show them their need of definite acceptance of Christ as Savior, or in order even to use disciplinary measures against them. Yes?
The council was one of those bodies that ruled Geneva.
Yes. The council is the civil body.
The 25 men?
There was the big council with 600, then there was the council of 200, and then there was the council of 25. And then there were four syndics who were the executive officers. They appointed the consistory. Yes.
Wouldn't that be, how did the separation of church and state consistent with
it? It was not, and Calvin didn't like it, and he wanted the church to appoint the elders. But Calvin never succeeded in persuading Geneva to adopt the complete system of church government that he would have liked. But he got them to move a very considerable distance in that direction. And then his pupils, who became leaders in the church in France and in Scotland, introduced his system into those countries. And in those countries, if you want to see Calvin's ideas carried out, you find it in France or in Scotland. In Geneva, you find Calvin trying hard in the midst of an already established system to move it in the direction of what he thought it should be. Yes? No. Well, there was considerable change in the matter of the appointment of the Council of 25 for a time, but eventually it became established that the Council of 200 elected the Council of 25. That became established. And the consistory were appointed by the Council of 25. They appointed the consistory. But if there were good men who were well-liked in the consistory, the Council of 25 would have to have pretty strong reason before they would change them. That is, you've got a new council maybe every year, every second year, but they wouldn't probably make changes immediately unless they had a pretty good reason they could present to the people. Yes? The consistory met once a week. And the... You see, the consistory had a great deal to do because the whole city was divided up into about six districts with one elder for each district. And this elder had responsibility to know the spiritual situation of each person in his area. So they were very busy men. Well, the consistory was a very active, energetic part of the religious life of Geneva, but nothing like Calvin wanted it to be, because he was hampered by the existing system. Yes? No. They had a secular job. The ministers were paid very little. The consistory was not paid. And the ministry was paid very little to. There was very, they were very poorly taken care of financially during these days. They had a struggle. But the consistory, that's another thing. Many people wouldn't take a position in the consistory because they weren't willing to give that time for it. And that helped to have worthy men. Then the number of small c, the relation to the civil government. Now, Calvin felt that it was the place of the civil government to maintain good order in the community. It was a part of the civil government to protect people and to do its part in protecting the church and in endeavoring to make Geneva a great Christian center. But that the religious life of the people was entirely a matter of the church. Now, civil government had introduced the Reformation. They had voted to adopt the Reformation. They had ordered the Roman leaders to get out of the city. They had invited Calvin to come. They had appointed the ministers, and they were very anxious to hold their position. And so Calvin had to make his fight on a few points. Calvin felt that the church had the right of determining what its services would be. And the church had the right of determining which members were in a proper spiritual condition to receive communion. And that was the strongest penalty that the church could make against anyone, was to order that they be not permitted to partake of communion. That, of course, goes by the name of excommunication. The church could say that a person must not be allowed to partake of communion. And this was considerable of a disgrace to people in that day. And so they had a considerable power through this, which was the strongest action that the church could take against anyone. But here he had some of his biggest struggles with the council, because some of his members felt that they established the church, they owned the church building, they had the right to say who could partake of communion. And he had some tough struggles on this line with the church, with the state. But now, small d, oversight of individual conduct. The oversight of individual conduct. And this is a matter on which Calvin is today frequently criticized, very strongly criticized, called a busybody, one who was looking into people's private affairs and interfering with them in all sorts of ways. And a great part of this criticism is absolutely undeserved, because people do not recognize what the situation was at the time. The situation was that every government at the time felt that it had a right to determine practically everything in the life of all its people. And practically every government had laws which, if strictly enforced, would have controlled just about every action of people's daily life. In England at this time, for instance, there were laws stating how people in different professions had to dress in certain ways. People in a certain position in life had to wear certain kinds of clothes, and they were not allowed to wear other clothes. There were laws as to what kind of names people could give their children. There were laws as to just about every phase of life. These laws were extremely detailed in just about every country or city or section in Europe. And as you would naturally expect with such a great number of laws of this type, which was found everywhere, the result was that if you had people in charge of the government who were interested in their own pleasure and wanted to be bothered as little as possible, the laws simply were not enforced at all. But that when the official had a grudge against somebody, he could easily find some law which he could enforce against them. And when you get somebody in who was conscientious and felt it was his duty to enforce the laws, you would suddenly find very strict laws being enforced that people had completely forgotten were on the statute book. And thus you had a great inequality, a great irregularity in the enforcement of these laws all over Europe. Now, Calvin did not introduce these laws, and he never had any official position in enforcing these laws. These were strictly a matter of the civil government. But Calvin exerted his influence to have the laws made more reasonable, to have them made more equitable, to remove laws that could not be enforced upon everybody, and then to insist that those that were kept as laws should be enforced equally upon all people. And this brought him into conflict with some of the leaders of Geneva who were accustomed to being the leading well-to-do people in the city and who thought some of these laws were mighty good to keep the rank and file in line, but certainly shouldn't apply to them. And Calvin insisted if they have the law at all, it should apply equally to everybody. And so the result is that in Geneva, during these years, you find the council enforcing very strict laws. There were certain times after which liquor could not be sold. And any tavern, any place where guests would stay overnight, and of course there were many taverns in Geneva because it was a city right on the high road of commerce and got a great part of its income from this fact, every tavern had to, no tavern could be run by a man who did not have a good reputation as a citizen. And he must have the Bible on the tables where it would be easily accessible for anybody who wanted to read it. And he must not allow the telling of licentious stories or the use of cursing language in his tavern. There were many other very strict laws about these taverns. And there were laws against blasphemy. I remember one time when I was with a fellow down in Philadelphia some years ago, and a drunken fellow came by and saw us and began swearing at us and cursing and using obscene language. And then he turned as if he was going to try to start a fight with us. And this, I told about the incident to an elderly woman. Oh, she said, but you should have reported him for his profanity. That's illegal in Philadelphia, because he used profanity and indecent language on the street. Well, that may have been in the laws of Philadelphia 100 years ago. But if you started in to enforce a rule like that today, you wouldn't have time to enforce any other laws, I'm sure. But Calvin felt that the laws should either be changed or should be enforced. He never had any official position in connection with their enforcement, but he had tremendous moral influence in this regard. And it is common among people today who hate Calvin to represent him as if he invented the whole system and as if he is responsible for that sort of a treatment of people. Now, Calvin's great concern in life was not to change Geneva into a city in which certain abstract principles might be in complete force, principles which are widely held today to be everybody's right, but which perhaps nobody had ever heard of then. His desire was to make Geneva a Christian city as far as he could, a city where God would be honored and which could be a center from which the gospel could go out throughout Europe. That was the ideal that he always kept before him, and in which he achieved such success as no one else in all history has ever achieved in a similar situation. So much then for this D, oversight of individual conduct. Now number three is an entirely different sort of thing. We'll speak of very briefly, recodification of laws and negotiations with barons. Recodification of laws and negotiations with barons. The people, the officials of Geneva were very proud that they had gotten back to their city. A man to have the leading position in its ecclesiastical life who had the tremendous ability that Calvin showed in his answer to Cardinal Sadolet. And they were determined to make use of his abilities for the welfare of the city. And so they asked Calvin to go over the law and to make suggestions for a new codification of the laws, for doing away with laws that were obsolete and making more irregularity in laws that had been passed sometimes 30, 50 years apart that more or less contradicted each other. And this took a great deal of time, but Calvin had legal training, He was anxious to do everything he could to help strengthen Geneva, and he took the time and effort that was involved in it. And he took an interest in everything in the welfare of the city. If he would notice any way in which the arrangement of the guards could be more efficient, in which the city could be safer in its situation, in which the civil government would run better. He was always looking for such things and making suggestions, but until 1559, he didn't even have a vote in the city. He was not even a citizen of the city, merely an employee of the government in the position as the chief minister. The negotiations with Bern were very important. Bern had the strongest army of any of the Swiss towns, and they had used their force to enable Geneva to retain its freedom after it had won it originally, but they had insisted if they helped Geneva that it let the Reformation preachers come in and preach. And it was a great help to Geneva and to its religious life. But among the leaders of Bern, there were people who had insisted on those exact arrangements of service which had resulted in Calvin and Farrell being driven from the city. Most of the people of Bern probably wanted Geneva simply to be another city that followed the Reformation. But there were among the leaders those who were looking out for their advantage. And Calvin was one of the group representing Geneva in the negotiations. Bern was a stronger city with a stronger army and located in a place much easier to defend. Geneva even today has France on three sides of it, so that it is a place which today would be almost impossible to defend if a strong attack were to be made against it. It was very important for them to keep on good terms with Bern, and some of the leaders of Bern were determined to use the utmost advantage that they could out of it. And so the result was that while before long Calvin was highly esteemed by the people of just about every other part of Switzerland, he had a good many enemies in the city of Bern, and continued so as long as he was there in Geneva. But Geneva doubtless got a much better deal in its relations with Bern than they would have if he had not given the time and nerve energy that he had to tutor. But as if you might think that what's been mentioned is enough for any man to do to keep him entirely busy, but Calvin was not satisfied. He was determined to see, so God had called him to make Geneva a great Reformation center. He was determined to do everything he could for that. And so number four is the Psalter. Number four is the Psalter. In the Romanist churches, all the singing had been in Latin. And all the singing had been done by a choir. The people simply listened. After my first year in seminary, I spent the summer in mission work out in New Mexico. And the little town in which I was, there were a large number of Romans, particularly people of Mexican or Spanish-American extraction. And I had little success in getting any of them to come to my service, but I called on all of them, and a few of them did. And in fact, quite a number started to, and then the priest, on his visit to the town every 2 weeks, found what was happening, and after that they didn't come anymore. But when they did come, the next time I called on them, I found that the thing that they were tremendously excited about was our congregational singing. They had nothing like that in their service. In their service, they simply sat and listened while the priest or the choir sang. And they were so much thrilled by the congregational singing in our service. Now, that was one thing that developed early in the Reformation, was having the laity not just be listeners, but having them be participants. And so Calvin set to work to translate the Psalms into French. The Psalms were in Latin. They were sung in Latin, as they still are in Roman services. He set to work to translate them into French for the services. And here he was fortunate in having a friendship with a very able French poet named Marot, M-A-R-O-T. Now, this man, unfortunately, did not have a very deep religious feeling. He had his feelings probably were very strong, but not very deep, as is often the case with poets, I guess. They would be very, very strong, but they would change. And so Marot was not a very consistent Protestant. Eventually, I believe he went back to the Roman Church where he could get better reward for his poetry. But while he was with Calvin, he translated a number of the Psalms into the most beautiful French. And Calvin translated the rest of them. And all of them made a great impression, but I think Marot made the greater impression of the two. But the Psalm book that they made was read not only in Geneva, but all over France. And in fact, even leaders of the Romans in France began to pick favorite Psalms from this book and became very fond of some of these Psalms. And so Calvin tried, as Luther had, to develop the musical life of the church. So he did not have as much musical ability, anything like, as Luther did. Then number five is Calvin's commentary. And no matter what people's, true Christians, people's attitudes may be regarding Calvin's theology, all denominations that study the Reformation at all or that go back to that time recognize him as the greatest exegete of the Reformation. And his commentaries have had great use among the all of the churches. But here we should give a word of warning. Calvin's commentaries cover perhaps 95%, at least 90% of the Bible. But his commentaries vary tremendously. That is to say, parts of them are made up of sermons that he gave, in which he went straight through sections of the Bible. And these sermons were taken down in shorthand and printed as they were, even including his prayers at the end of each sermon. And even in these, you will find many very suggestive ideas and much real insight into the Scripture. But they were not revised, they were not edited by him, they were not studied over a second time. The talking in them, the language may be rather extemporary. Then there were other cases where his commentaries consist of discussion of a book which he went over and over and revised and worked it. And so you will find some of his commentaries very carefully made, fine books that anyone would be proud of. And other parts of it are sermons that he gave which were very good as he delivered sermons, but which for a written thing he would have wanted to go over and work over the language of and perhaps check on some of the minor points in them. And so you find great variety in the quality. All of them have good material, but some of them are far better worked out than others. Number six is Calvin's correspondence. How some of those people in those days could remember things is difficult for anyone to believe with all the help we have today. I've heard of people back in those days who would start dictating a letter and be halfway through and all of a sudden be interrupted. And they'd be interrupted and be in the midst of busy activities, keep busy for 10 days, and then they'd come back and they'd start in with the next word in the middle of the sentence and go on and finish dictating the letter. I doubt if anybody could do that today. Well, I don't know how much Calvin wrote with his own hand, how much he dictated, but he wrote in his lifetime thousands of letters. He wrote letters to whenever he would hear of anyone anywhere in Europe of any prominence who was thought to be moving favorably toward the Reformation, he would write them a letter, giving them reasons why they should. When he heard of problems, he would write to people, and they would write back. When his academy was established there, and he had students, some of them rather young, he would even get letters from the parents of young people saying they were afraid this young person was in danger of marrying the wrong person, and so he looked into it and see if they were possibly in the danger of marrying the wrong person and possibly find them the right mate. And Calvin would take time with these things. He took time and effort in this very extensive correspondence, much of which has been translated, much of which has not, but is still in the original Latin. I have a friend who took a PhD in Harvard Divinity School with reading several hundred of Calvin's letters in the Latin and writing a thesis about them. His letters had a great influence all over Europe. Number seven, the academy. He developed the school there, which became a great center for people going all over Europe for carrying the gospel. Then number eight, the refugees. Many people from France fleeing for their lives would go in almost any direction where they might get safety. But soon Calvin's name and writings became known, so a great number of them came into Geneva, and you had a great increase in population, which the older people, the older inhabitants looked at askance. Didn't like these new people. They were glad to keep them from starving, but they weren't anxious they become citizens of Geneva. But Calvin eventually succeeded in gaining citizenship for them. There were some who came from Italy. There was a man named Bernardino Occhino, O-C-H-I-N-O, who was head of the Capuchin order. The Capuchins are one of the branches of the Franciscans. They say today you can recognize a Franciscan by his brown robe with usually a rope tied around it. And if he has a beard, he's a Capuchin. He doesn't have a beard. He's one of the other branches of the Franciscans. They are very commonly seen today in many parts of the world. Well, the Capuchins had been formed not long before this. And Occhino was the third general-in-chief of the Capuchin order. He was a great preacher, known all over Italy. He began reading Reformation books, became thoroughly convinced of salvation by faith. He was re-elected twice as general of the Capuchin order. He went all over Italy preaching. Great crowds came to hear him, and he preached salvation by faith. And then word of this came to Rome, and he was the Counter-Reformation by this time was in full swing. We look at the Counter-Reformation later. He heard that he was summoned to Rome to answer for his view, and he knew of others who had been burned at the stake for their beliefs. He knew what would happen to him, and like Virgilio, whom we've already mentioned, who was the papal legate whom Luther had talked with Occhino, put on women's skirts over his monkey's garments, disguised himself in some way, and managed, instead of going south to Rome, to go north and get out of Italy. And he came to Geneva. Unfortunately, wonderful preacher he was in Italian, he was greatly hampered in speaking other languages. So while he still had an influence for the Lord for the rest of his life, it was nothing like what it had been when he was in Italy. Now there were also refugees came from England and from Scotland. When Queen Mary tried to do away with Protestantism in England, they had many refugees there. Then, number nine, the civic help. I've already mentioned how Calvin introduced the silk industry, which within a few years resulted in their having double the income coming into the city they'd had before, and greatly strengthened the city of Geneva. Now we go on to H. 8 years of difficulty, 1547 to 1553. 8 years of difficulty. These eight, after having a period in which everyone thought it was wonderful. They had a great man like Geneva as their chief minister, and they were using him in every possible way. There came to the fore more and more the feeling among people that they did not like what Calvin was doing, and they'd like to get rid of it. And so, number one is the source of the events, the source of the attacks on Calvin. There were two main sources. We might call these the patriots and the libertines. Now the patriots were the old members of Geneva, the old family. They wanted to believe in Geneva for the Geneva. It was fine to have this great preacher from abroad be here as an employee, but they didn't like to give citizenship to anybody that didn't have ancestors who for 100 years had been living in Geneva. This was their city. They had lived here for centuries. Why should all these upstarts and foreigners come in and get more and more influence in the city? And more a group of these people became strong opponents of Calvin. Along with this, there were libertines. Now the two overlap to some extent. But the libertines, they called themselves libertines. Perhaps the bad odor the word libertine has today comes partly from the way they use it then. But the libertines were, they applied the name themselves. They didn't want to be tied by these rules about having the Bible available and not using profane language and going to church every Sunday and all these laws that they had there. They wanted to live their lives and enjoy themselves and maybe go to church once in a while, but why get excited about these things? And so some of them went to an extreme in their private meetings and aroused enmity of everybody in Geneva against them. Yes?
What was the first group?
The Patriots.
Patriots,
yeah. They call themselves the patriots. That's patria of the fatherland, the old citizens from way back. But some of these libertines carry things to such an extreme that the civil government, in the course of the next few years, executed a number of them, beheaded a number of them, while a number of others were driven from the city. But they were exerting a very considerable influence during these 7 years. They have opposition to, yes? Well, I said 8 years of difficulty, 1547 to 55. You cannot figure exactly because the opposition gradually developed. Then it became very strong, but never quite strong enough to drive him out of the city. So there were many who would like to. And then the opposition was completely overcome. And that also didn't happen in a day. So 8 years is rather rough, general terms. But these 8 years were a very difficult time for Calvin. Now, Calvin had been, with all the work he'd been doing, he'd been getting very little sleep. He was not naturally strong anyway. He was small, and his health had often been poor. He'd overworked terribly during his college years. And his health was bad. He would sometimes have kidney stones, which I've heard people speak of as the most excruciating agony. He would have one of them right in the middle of one of his sermons. He'd just clench his teeth and maybe hold his fist tight and go right on with his sermon. And only those who knew him well would notice his face got a little pale and notice how he was clenching his fist, but he'd keep right on. He never allowed his sermon to be interrupted by a mere kidney stone. But he had great health difficulties, and as a matter of fact, he died in 1564 when he was only 55 years of age. But he accomplished probably four times what most people would ever accomplish in a lifetime. But he faced this opposition. So long as he felt he was standing for the Word of God, he did not give in to it at all. There were people who would name their dog Calvin, and they would call, "Calvin, come here, Calvin." When they see him walking down the street, somebody say, "That's no way to speak to minister. I was talking about the minister, talking about my dog over here." That's his name. But many went much further than that. One time he came to a group of men who were so incensed against him, they were saying how they'd like to kill this fellow Calvin, what they'd do to him. And as he came along, and they were right in the road where he had to go by, and the feeling was so intense that he didn't know what might happen. He came up near them, he pulled open his shirt, and he says, "If you want to kill me, here's the place to strike." And opened his shirt, and fellows drew back, and he walked on. But of course, there might have been some hothead there who would have done it. But in the end, his influence was much greater than if he'd run around the corner or something. Then they shoot off guns near his window when he was studying, preparing his sermon. And he went through tremendous difficulties during these years. And to go into the details of it would take a long time. We haven't time this year. But we must speak about a matter which is one of the things for which Calvin is most criticized today. And we'll call that the Servetus Affair. The Servetus Affair. Capital S-E-R-V-E-T-U-S. Summer 2, we'll call it. Under H. The Servetus Affair. Now, Miguel Servetus, S-E-R-V-E-T-U-S, was a brilliant Spaniard. He was a Spaniard who turned violently against the Roman Church, but also was against the Protestant Church. He was a man who was a brilliant student. There's good evidence that he discovered the circulation of the blood years before Harvey, the English physician, discovered it. And it became widely known, and Harvey's given credit for it. Well, it did not become widely known from Servetus, but it is found in his work. He discovered the circulation of the blood. He was well-trained in medicine, as anybody could be in those days. But he was determined that Trinitarian Christianity was wrong, and he wanted to destroy it. And when Calvin was still in Paris, he once challenged Calvin to a debate on the Trinity, and then he did not appear for some reason when they were supposed to have this debate. But Calvin met him at different places two or three times, and he was very violent in his language about Calvin. He wrote a book called The Restitution of Christianity, in which There's nothing that is too strong for him to say against those who believe in the Trinity. He carried on a correspondence with Calvin. He had a publisher who published his work. And this publisher published them in without telling where Servetus was. And he would send letters to the publisher, which the publisher would send to Calvin from Servetus, which called Calvin all sorts of names, called him stupid and ignorant and foolish for believing in the Trinity, and assailed his ideas and his attitudes. And Calvin would try to answer them with arguments from the Scripture, but he carried this on for quite a time. Once he got a copy of Calvin's Institute, and he went through it, and he marked on the margin, utter stupidity, crazy nonsense, foolishness, and marks like this all through, and he got his publisher to mail it to Calvin with all this in it. Well, he lived for about 20 years in a French city called Villeneuve in southern France. Or no, he used the name Villeneuve. The city was called Vienne in southern France, V-I-E-N-N-E. And under the secret name of Villeneuve, he lived there as a well-considered physician who always attended Mass and was very faithful in his Roman Catholic observances. But secretly, he was writing these letters to Calvin and having these books published by people in other countries. And then, in Vienne, it was found out who he was, and he was arrested. And the Romanist officials there decided that on the ground of his attack on the doctrine of the Trinity, that he should be burned, publicly burned. But he escaped. Now, during these years, the Romanists burned dozens of Protestants, dozens of them. And in fact, I think it runs into the hundreds that were burned by the Romanists, many of them very earnest Christians who denied the Mass and the Roman Catholic doctrine. Some of them even who had not publicly done it. In the Inquisition in Spain, if they caught a man of Jewish descent who was considered an earnest Christian, if they caught him not eating pork, or if they caught him working on Saturday or something like that, he could be taken by the Inquisition and tortured till he confessed he was a real Jew at heart and then burned at the stake. I do not know of any case where Protestants burned a man for religious reasons except in the case of Servetus. And there is more said about this one case than there is about the hundreds of cases where the Romanists burned Protestants. And he was not a Romanist. He was an opponent of all Trinitarian belief. But Villeneuve escaped from Vienne. Yes? His charge was attacking the Trinity. Attacking the doctrine. How's that? By Romans. Yes, and they condemned him for it, and he was to be burned, but he escaped. And when he escaped, he headed for northern Italy, where he thought he could secure protection, but on the way, he stopped in Geneva. And there in disguise, he was there several weeks. And then the last Sunday before he was to leave Geneva, he went to church, and somebody recognized him, and he was seized. And he was tried by the council in Geneva. And Calvin appeared as prosecutor. And Calvin presented the evidence of the letters and the copy of the Institute. And Calvin declared that this man was one who was actively trying to destroy Christian faith. Not a Romanist trying to destroy Protestantism, but a man who was trying to destroy all the essential Christian faith, and that he should not be permitted to carry on this activity. And members of the council at this time, the little council of 25, tried him. And the little council was at this time made up to a large extent of men who were hostile to Calvin, and who desired to hurt Calvin in every way they could. And when Calvin declared that this was a wicked man who was attacking all true belief in God, and who was a danger to all the world, the greater number of the members of the council decided that they should support this man. And so he was given as fair a trial as anybody could ever have. They did everything in his favor. They submitted Calvin to certain indignities when he appeared as prosecutor. They tried to, and in fact, all of this gave Servetus a false security. And so when Servetus was asked, "Are you guilty?" he said, "No, I'm standing for true Christianity." He said, "Calvin's the one who should be arrested. He ought to be imprisoned because he's perverting the faith of people and giving them these teachings about the Trinity," and so on. And he spoke in the strongest, most insolent language against Calvin when he felt the little council was for him. But the little council overstepped itself in its hatred of Calvin. They defended Servetus in such a way that they gave Servetus such confidence that he didn't do much to try to dissemble his views. And Calvin had abundant evidence of what his attitudes were. The trial went on for a good many weeks. But in the end, the evidence was so clear that the members of the little council made themselves obviously in the face of most of the people of Geneva, people who were ready to stand against what most of the people in Geneva stood for in order to hurt Calvin. And so when all the evidence was in, and the decision had to be made, the council was in a very difficult situation. And so the council said, "We will ask the advice of the other cities of Switzerland." And so they wrote four cities of Switzerland, sent them the transcript of the trial, asked their leaders what they thought of this man. And all four of them wrote back strongly stating that a man who held views such as this should not be permitted to propagate his views, but that a complete end should be made to his activities, which would sound as if he should be killed in those days when that was the common treatment for people toward whom they felt in that way. And Calvin felt that the man should be beheaded. But the council, having opposed Calvin all through, now they would not agree with Calvin, so they said, "No, he should be burnt." And so the council voted unanimously that Servetus should be burnt at the stake. First, they defended him all this time. Then, when they found that they were in an impossible position, and Calvin was standing for having him killed in a way that did not involve much suffering, they jumped to the opposite extreme and said he should be burnt. Calvin opposed it. He favored his execution, but he opposed his being burnt. But he was burned at the stake, and ever since that has been, people, as I say, forget the hundreds of cases where Romans burned Protestants, but they talk about this one case. The Protestants are no better than the Romanists. Look, they burned Servetus. And even within this century, there was a monument put up in Geneva by a lot of Protestant church bodies from all over the world, put up this as an expiation for the great harm wrong done to Servetus. They put up this monument to this great champion of religious liberty. Well, Servetus was not a champion of religious liberty, but he was a strong opponent of some of the central doctrines of Christianity. But the result of this was that it made the council so obvious before the people of Geneva that it was the thing which broke the back of the opposition to Calvin. And the result of the trial of Servetus was that the opposition to the leading members of the council became stronger and stronger, and within a year or two after this, the new election solidly swept the council and filled it with people who were favorable to Calvin. So for the remaining 10 years of Calvin's life, he had a council in Geneva which was 100% for him and was thankful for his advice on almost any subject, and anxious to do whatever he thought. And so in those last 10 years, he had an opportunity to do a tremendous lot in making Geneva a great Christian center, which it remained for a century or two after his death, such as no city in the world has ever been before or since. And a great center which had more of an influence in spreading Christianity than any other single city has had in the world's history before or since. It was the Servetus affair which in the immediate situation broke the back of the opposition and gave Calvin complete control as far as Geneva was concerned, but which since that has been used as a great argument against Calvin. Well, we continue there tomorrow.